All right, so no Zach, Roman is walking in, no Allison yet, no Elizabeth, Cadence as always, no Nick yet, Gage is here, Jimmy, Chris is here, and Eli is here, oh, and Rich is here. Okay. So, new topic today. We're done with Congress. We are going to start the executive branch. We know the legislative branch, but what takes place at the branch entrusted with doing what? What is the job of the executive branch?
Execute.
Execute what? The law, exactly. What does that mean?
To enforce it.
Okay, good, to enforce it. Very good. Now, when the Founding Fathers designed our system, obviously they had experience because they had lived in a system where there was a monarchy. But England in the 1760s and 1770s was not an absolutist monarchy. It was not a system like was in France. Rather, England had a constitutional monarchy. What's the difference between an absolutist monarchy and a constitutional monarchy? Sure, absolutely.
Does like a constitutional monarchy have like outlines of what the monarch is able to do?
Yeah, absolutely.
In an absolutist monarchy, theoretically, there's not checks and balances on the monarch's power.
So to buttress on what Gage said, in a constitutional monarchy, there are guidelines. Absolutist monarchy, there's not. So what's the outcome for the people?
They're subject to the whims of the.
Yeah, so in an absolutist system, the king can basically do whatever he wants, whereas a constitutional monarchy?
Not really.
There are limitations.
The constitutional, that's what Parliament was, right?
Kind of. The constitutional system in England, they did have a series of documents that went all the way back to the Magna Carta that took away certain powers of the king. And then there were laws that were passed that further did that. So basically, King George was not a figurehead like Charles II is today. He still did have some authority, but most of the enforcement was done by the Prime Minister and the Cabinet of Ministers, who were appointed by Parliament. So when you see references to the Founding Fathers chafing against executive power, it's not just the king. They're also talking about what a series of prime ministers did and what the cabinet ministers did and how laws were enforced. So don't think it was tyrannical old King George. And if you actually read the documents from the Founding Fathers, what they were saying was that the king was not doing enough to stop the ministers. Which is kind of interesting. And again, all you got to do is look at our history. Look at what happened after the French and Indian War. You had a desire to basically pay the debt of the English Empire, debt that was incurred for the benefit of the American colonists. I mean, defeating the French and getting them out of North America, that basically would guarantee that Americans had limitless potential to access real estate and out of that real estate make money. So what the crown was trying to do is the crown was trying to impose taxes so that way the colonists would pay their fair share. But the colonists did not want that, so that's what they rose up against. They rose up against the Stamp Act. They rose up against the Molasses Act. They rose up against the Tea Act and the Intolerable Acts. And it was protest after protest after protest. Then it culminated in the Declaration of Independence. Because like I said, if you read the part that you probably have never read, the list of grievances, not the all men are created and endowed with certain unalienable rights, not that part, that's the preamble. But the meat and potatoes of the Declaration of Independence are those 26 grievances that are listed at the end. And what all of those are, essentially, is an indictment against the executive branch for, and I quote, the injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states, end quote. So, in creating a new system, they didn't want that. They didn't want an executive branch that basically could impose its will. But at the same time, they didn't want rule by a committee. And why? It's obvious. Did I do the pizza game with you guys?
Yes.
Trying to get everyone to agree on the same type of pizza order?
Yeah.
You can't do it. You can't put a room of people together and have them all agree on something. Plus, that's what they had under the Articles of Confederation. They had rule by committee for almost a decade, and that didn't work. As Alexander Hamilton wrote in Federalist 68, the true test of government is its aptitude and tendency to produce a good administration. If you have 10 people voicing their opinions on something, you don't get good government. Why? Human nature. Sometimes people are shy. Sometimes people are afraid of controversy. Sometimes they're afraid of criticism. And then on the exact opposite side, you have people that refuse to compromise. You have people that are ego-driven. So if you put a group of people together and all you're going to get is a clash of personalities, how are you going to have a government that's going to work? So, in framing their vision for what the executive branch would be, essentially what they would try doing is taking both. Taking both. To allow there to be basically one person to eliminate the debate, but at the same time to restrain them through sufficient checks and balances. So that way, the executive could not essentially become tyrannical. But here's the thing. The problem, and the reason why the presidency is as powerful as it is today, it's because of history. So go back in time, even in your short lives, and see all that's happened. From 9/11, we've had market crashes, we've had COVID, etc., etc., etc. So, what was their intent? You cannot understand, and I've said this before, you cannot understand the United States government without knowing how it's supposed to work. Because we all can sit back and we can criticize. Oh, big brother in government's out to get me. Yeah, to a degree they are. But how do we get here? And what should it be? Well, luckily, the Founding Fathers gave us the blueprint, the Constitution. All of the things that the president can do, constitutionally speaking, can be found within Article 2 of the Constitution. It is, coincidentally, the second longest article in the Constitution, with the first, of course, being Article 1. Article 2 creates some specific powers, but it also provides some that are kind of open-ended. Beginning with, really, maybe Teddy Roosevelt, presidents throughout the 20th century and into the 21st century have taken advantage of that open-ended nature, vagueness, to essentially expand upon the scope and authority of the office. Each president, in other words, has successively become more powerful based on the actions of his predecessor. All right, let's look at what the president can do. Well, Article 1, Section 1, Clause 1 tells us that all executive power, all of the power of the federal government, law enforcement, is vested in one person, the President of the United States, the POTUS. Now, of course, I don't think any of you have ever in your lives seen, be it Trump, Biden, Trump, Obama. You guys live? Yeah, Bush. You guys are live with Bush. Driving around in a police car, pulling people over, giving them tickets. You know, obviously, the president, he is the chief executive, but it's not the chief that wields the power. Most of the president's executive power has been delegated to the people in the executive branch. But, to a degree, the buck does still stop with the chief executive. Article 2, Section 3, known as the Take Care Clause, requires that the President of the United States, and I quote, take care that the laws be faithfully executed. So, I'll give you something controversial. When Joe Biden, as president, refused to enforce any immigration laws, he essentially was violating the Constitution of the United States. If Congress passes a law, it's not up to the president to ignore it. The law is the law. The executive branch is supposed to enforce the laws. And by the way, in theory, Congress should be checking to make sure that the laws are enforced. Because as we said, Congress has oversight authority. So, on said example, Congress, during the second session of Biden's term, when the Republicans took control of the House, they held hearings on immigration matters. They brought in executive officials and demanded that they testify under oath before Congress. All you got to do is go back and watch videos of when Mayorkas was there. I mean, man, was he slick. You could tell he was a politician. He was slippery and slimy. It was all about, like, what is. Never really answered direct questions. But in that is a good example. What happens if the president doesn't enforce laws? What can Congress do about it? Well, they could impeach him. They could impeach department heads. But that's very, 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 very rare. in U.S. history. President also has the power to pardon. This comes from Article 2, Section 1, Clause 1. Now, when you receive a pardon, well, actually, I'll ask, what is a pardon?
Like the government doesn't recognize your crimes anymore?
What do you mean, crimes? Okay. Mm-hmm. Who determines whether or not you broke the law?
Court
does. So what a pardon does is it wipes away your record if you have been prosecuted. But interestingly enough, in modern years, it has also been used preemptively to wipe away allegations of crime. Why do I phrase it that way? Well, if you go back and look at people who say George Washington pardoned, they actually went to court, they were put on trial, they were found guilty. But
did something like that happen with Lyndon B. Johnson and Nixon?
Nixon, that's exactly where I was going, but LBJ was not involved.
Oh, I thought, wasn't that his vice president?
No. Who was Nixon's vice president? Ford.
Oh, okay.
All right, that's exactly right. So what came out of the Nixon pardon was different from the original intent, because Nixon was not actually charged with anything. They were working on impeachment in the House because they had evidence of his knowledge of the break-in in Watergate, which, by the way, was not the worst crime in history. I am so tired in my lifetime. Oh, it's worse than Watergate, or it's as bad as Watergate. No. Watergate was piddly in comparison to what people in our federal government get away with. But it's just famous. So essentially the president knew, they had evidence that the president knew. The president was questioned, wasn't formally deposed, but was questioned, and basically said he didn't know anything, and they had proof of otherwise. So they were going to impeach him. Now, would he have been found guilty in the Senate? Doubt it. The Democrats didn't have a large enough control of the Senate. But Nixon was dealing with some serious stuff in his second term, including the withdrawal from Vietnam, as well as negotiations with Communist China, also negotiations with the Soviet Union. So rather than putting the nation through an impeachment trial, which you've had to live through two of them, Nixon decided, because he couldn't run for a second term anyways, he decided for the good of the nation to step down. That was not an admission of guilt. What it was, I just don't want the nation to rip itself apart. Because look at what happened when Trump was on trial. You had all the Democrats saying, oh, hang him, hang him, hang him. And you had all the Republicans saying, you Democrats are dumb. And what did that get us? This is what it got us. And that's not helpful. By the way, it's going to be interesting to see how the courts are going to react to what Biden did. Because people like Fauci were given a pardon even though there was no actual allegations of any wrongdoing. You know, at least Nixon, they were drafting something. So I don't know if the courts are going to allow it to go that far.
Is there validity to them being null and void, most of those pardons, because they were signed with an auto pen and there's little to no evidence that Biden even knew?
All right, well, you want to get that nuanced? It depends upon what the courts say. Yeah, there's no actual proof that he actually signed them.
Yeah.
Do y'all know what an auto pen is? the president has electronic device that he basically pre-enters his signature into a computer on his first day in office. And all they have to do is put a document down, and it's almost like a printer. It will basically just print the signature on a document. So, I don't know. It all depends upon what judge it goes before. Because I could see the argument on both sides. All right. Appointments. The president also has the power to appoint. This comes from Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2. Who does he appoint? Oh, I thought I had another click. All right, I'll do that one first. I'm going to write something before. I want you to put something in. Don't write the SCOTUS yet. All executive officers and ambassadors. That's what should be first. All executive officers and ambassadors. All executive officers and ambassadors. Most presidential appointments serve at the will of the president. They don't serve a fixed term. So, if one of the secretaries in the cabinet does something that the president doesn't like, they essentially can be fired and they can be replaced. There's nothing wrong about it. There's nothing controversial about it. And it happens frequently. Trump, in his first term, had a lot of turnover. Biden didn't get rid of too many, and he probably should have. I think Biden would have been better in the polls if he got rid of those people, like Mayorkas. But, I don't know, it could have been loyalty. I don't know what the reason why Biden did fire people. Trump's like firing people. Obama, he also was quick to terminate people.
Firing people is kind of Trump's whole MO.
That was his shtick on the show. But again, in terms of the great Terminator in chief, you got to look at Obama's record. Obama was big time. Obama actually fired more people than any other president in modern history, second only to Bill Clinton. So again, the president does have the power to fire those people in the cabinet and the heads of the different federal agencies. But as important as they are, the most important appointment that the president can have are Supreme Court justices. Why? How long is one's term if they get appointed to the Supreme Court? They get a lifetime appointment. What does that mean?
Until they retire.
Yeah. Ultimately, they're in charge of their term. They can stay on the court as long as they want to. How do you get them off other than resignation or death?
Assuming they have to be, do they have to be impeached?
They do. They have to go through the impeachment process. So they have to be accused by a majority in the House, and then there has to be a hearing, 2/3 of the Senate, to remove them. By the way, because they get lifetime tenure, they could be on there for decades after the president leaves office. So, the example I have in my notes, Chief Justice John Marshall, who we talked about, was appointed by John Adams, the second president of the United States, but remained Chief Justice until 1835. So, Jefferson for two terms, Madison for two terms, Monroe for two terms, John Quincy Adams for one term, and into Jackson's two terms. That's five presidencies. So what's the significance? Well, if you think about it, because they're picked by the president because of politics, That means a president's politics will influence the federal government for years to come. And that's why Trump, when he flipped the court from 4 conservatives, 4 liberals, 1 swing justice to 6-3, it was a multi-generational shift. It was the first time since FDR did it back in the 30s that the court went from leaning one way to going the other. You generally don't see that, but the impact is going to be huge. Now, by the way, the longest tenured justice in the history of the United States was one of the judges that were one of the New Deal judges put on the court by FDR. He was on the court for 36 years, 211 days. But you know who might catch it? Clarence Thomas, who's still a justice on the Supreme Court. He's
I think already at 36 years.
So we actually might have a new record. And Clarence Thomas is still relatively young. He's only 78. That gentleman right there.
How old was the first gentleman?
Sorry?
How old was the first guy that made it to that had a 36 year career on this?
I think he was in his 40s when he got appointed. All right. Now, the only catch with all the appointments is the hearings. If you were paying attention to what was going on in January and into February, when all the cabinet appointees had to go before the Senate, it was all televised, there was a lot of pageantry. Because it's a Republican president, all of the Republicans, members of the committees, you know, gave them all softball questions, and all of the Democrats were like, you're Nazis. But as I said before, if you had a Democrat administration, it's politics, baby. It just simply reverses. But ultimately, the party in charge of the Senate determines whether or not the president can get his man or woman into that appointment. So currently, the Republicans have a majority, so everybody has sailed through. Even, I think, Robert Kennedy was probably the most controversial. I think out of anyone, that was the one that they were saying might actually lose. But even he got 51 votes. So, now, prior to Inauguration Day, I did hear Trump talking about this. There's an interesting situation contained in Article 2, Section 2, Clause 3. And these are known as recess appointments. It's kind of like a loophole in the whole nominate, advise, consent restrictions that is placed on the executive branch. A recess appointment is an appointment when the Senate is not in session. So, if for whatever reason the Senate adjourns, the president can put in any person they want into that position and they don't have to go through a hearing. The catch is, though, the appointment expires at the end of the next term. So, what does that mean? If Trump was to put in members of the cabinet through recess appointments, they only could stay until the midterm election. Then they would leave. And, by the way, they wouldn't get a hearing unless the president chose to renominate them. So Trump was talking, like Trump talks, that, you know, if the Senate doesn't put his guy or gal in, that he would work with the Senate president to basically recess the Senate for a couple of weeks, then he'd pack all his appointments through. I mean, technically it's illegal, but why? You know, my take is just do it the right way. You don't want to set that precedent, because what do you think the next guy or gal in the executive office is going to try doing?
Follow suit.
Exactly, if not worse.
Right.
All right, questions on taking care clause, power to pardon, appointments. All right, what about the veto? Article 1, Section 7, Clause 2 gives the president the power to veto laws passed by Congress. But the catch is, as I told you before when we're talking about how a bill becomes law, they have to be a qualified negative veto. So the president can't just say no. The president has to explain why. They have to qualify that. They have to give their reasonings. And the reason why the president is required to give a qualified negative veto, because the bill then goes back to Congress. Congress reads the reason why the president doesn't like it, and then they have the option to override the president's veto. By what vote in both chambers? Two-thirds. Now, FYI, my numbers are not updated. The last time I updated them was back in 2021. But as of 2021, in U.S. history, there were a total of 1,516 qualified negative vetoes. I'm sure it's a little more. The president with the record of most vetoes was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Over his 3.25 terms, he vetoed 372 laws. Very few were overridden because the Democrats had a control of the Senate. Second place, the only other president to have non-consecutive terms, Grover Cleveland. He vetoed 304 laws. But if you consider the two, Cleveland did 304 in two terms, where FDR did 372 in 3.25 terms. So Grover Cleveland, he just liked vetoing everything. Why? Because he could. But compare that to the modern presidents again, as of 2021. When I did this last update, Biden hadn't vetoed anything. Trump had vetoed 10 during his first term. Obama did 12. Bush did 12. And Bill Clinton did 36. Hand, yes.
Never mind.
Okay.
Sorry, I looked up the vetoes, but it's the wrong number.
Okay. I know it's more.
Yeah, this says it's 2,000, but it's including, it's counting regular vetoes and pocket vetoes together.
Oh, no, you can't. Actually, that should be higher. That should be about like 2,500.
Yeah, 2,595.
Yep. Do you want to know how I know that? Because it was 1,067 pocket vetoes. All right, let me see. The president who had the record of most of his vetoes being overridden was Andrew Jackson. He had 15 of his vetoes overridden. Second place was Harry S. Truman and the aforementioned Gerald Ford. Both of them had 12. All right. The only exception to the qualified negative veto being overridden is pocket veto. This is an interesting device, and it can't be overridden. Now, the Constitution in Article 1 expressly states that any bill not signed or vetoed by the president within 10 days of the end of a session, not including Sundays, becomes the law. Okay? Unless the Congress is adjourned. So, what typically happens is the Congress spends all year having their hearings, doing the markups, doing the amendments, doing the riders, doing the debate. And then as the end of the session, which is 1 year of a two-year term, they take a whole bunch of bills and dump them on the president's desk. Back in the day, in about September, October, Congress then went home because it took some of them weeks to go by horse or by carriage. And they did not come back until March. So what would happen is the president would have this big stack of bills on his desk. Up until James Madison, attributed as being the father of the Constitution, the presidents just simply signed them diligently, and everything got filed. But when Madison was president, because he wrote the damn Constitution, he realized this loophole. So, during the War of 1812, Congress tried passing naturalization laws. It was the first time Congress was going to interfere with the states' rights. Because, by the way, prior to the 14th Amendment, citizenship was determined by the states. So Congress passed this law through, and Madison's like, no, this is unconstitutional. But the bill came in with 6 days left of the session. So he waited, and he waited, and he waited. Congress adjourns, everyone goes home. He takes the bill, folds it up, and put it in his desk. Why? Because he knew the state courts were not going to allow this law to stand, and it would create a national controversy. So, he used the pocket bill to kill it. Because he didn't want illegal immigrants exploiting the tensions between the states and the federal government. Which is kind of ironic when you think about what's going on now, when the states are battling the national government over immigration. By the way, pocket veto 1,067 times. Modern presidents, though, can't really do it anymore. Because, generally speaking, Congress is in session. And all they got to do is, if they know there's a big bill, they don't allow it to be dumped on the president's desk, you know, 10 days before Christmas. All right. Well, again, here's something that's antiquated. Doesn't really happen anymore, but it's there. The president does have the authority, Article 2, Section 3, to force Congress to come back if they adjourn. So let's say back in the old-timey days, when they were done in September or October, it didn't come back until March or April. Well, something bad happens in December. The president had the ability to send out communications and basically require all members of Congress to come back to the federal government and have a special session. This actually dates back to the English constitutional system. That was a power the king had. Well, what happens if Congress is being a pain in the tuchus and they refuse to adjourn for some reason? Well, interestingly enough, the president also has the authority to force them to adjourn. But off the top of my head, I honestly can't think of a single time in U.S. history when the president did that. There's another power of the president. Executive order. Sorry, don't mind me. I want to have updated numbers on this. Orders. Total. Because President Trump has been having fun with them. Let's see where we're at. I suppose I will go to the White House. Sorry, I'm trying to find. Well, there we go. Presidential actions. Oh, they're not numbered. Damn it. They have all the exact. All right, well, I'll just talk about it, and then someone can do the Google on your own. Executive orders. This is one of the most interesting powers of the President of the United States because this is a power not expressly in the Constitution. It's not there. There's no article, no section, no clause that says the President has the authority to issue executive orders. But if you think about it, if the President is the chief executive, and his job is to take care that all the laws are faithfully executed, and he has to delegate his authority to people below him, it kind of makes sense, therefore, he should be able to tell them how to enforce the law. Executive orders, however, should not be used to make law, but rather they can tell members of the executive branch, FBI agents, ICE agents, how the president wants them to conduct their business. And why do I describe it that way? Well, the very first executive order was issued by the very first president of these United States. George Washington, as president, was concerned that we were going to get dragged in to the wars of the French Revolution. England and France were fighting one another. England and France were both trying to drag us in on their side, and both were doing violations of international law. One of the biggest things that England and France was doing is they were using impressment. So they literally were stopping our ships in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and seizing them, claiming them as war prizes. Not cool at all. But Washington didn't want us to get involved in our war because, again, if you read his farewell address, Washington warned America to beware of foreign entanglements. We should not be the world police. We should mind our own P's and Q's. So, Washington issued the order to the federal agents, all of the people that worked, the justices of the peace, and all of the other federal agents that, you know, ran the ports and did investigations, to arrest anyone suspected of violating his neutrality order. So, to give you a modern example, imagine that 30-year-old MIT student from Turkey here on a visa that was advocating for us to attack Israel in support of the Palestinians, that actually would fall under George Washington's order because she's trying to get us involved in a war that's none of our business. Now, why didn't Washington just have Congress pass the law? Congress had adjourned. They were gone. We were on the cusp of being dragged into an international war. The president didn't want a single incident that could spark a war. So as a general that led us in our war of independence, he acted like a military officer and issued orders to his subordinates. Now, since Washington has been president, again, we're talking probably close to 15,000 executive orders. Number I had in 2021 was 14,000. But I know Biden did a bunch and Trump has done a bunch.
The record holder, FDR. 3,728. Think of when he was president. Great Depression, World War II. The record holder with the least, William Henry Harrison. Why obviously?
He was only in office for a month.
Exactly. He got pneumonia because he gave the longest inaugural address at a day that it was record cold in Washington, D.C., and he died.
To prove his youth and virility.
Yeah, to prove that he was an alpha male. I'm going to go speak for 3.5 hours, wearing only a suit jacket. Yeah, that worked out well for him. Now, here's the thing. If the president issues an executive order, it has the force of law. But it can be challenged in the courts. So if you're paying attention to the news, even half-heartedly, you've probably heard a whole bunch of times, this person suing Trump, this person suing Trump, that person suing Trump. It's part of the process. Part of the process. But here's the thing. The only way a court can rule against an executive order is if it's completely out of bounds of the scope of the law. So, you may have heard about that one judge that declared that the president's flight to El Salvador was illegal. Well, the problem is if that gets up to the Supreme Court is going to say no. The president does have deportation powers.
Yeah, it's a weird precedent to set because as soon as you see, there was a bunch of headlines like that. It's like a federal judge can't alter the decisions of the president of the United States. Who do you people think you are?
I know.
Like, bring that plane down now.
It's not even the Supreme Court, though. It's one federal district judge.
District Court of Delaware or something. Yeah. It's like trying to boss the president around.
Well, I did read that there is an effort in the Congress to basically, because don't forget, when we talk about the courts, Congress controls the jurisdiction of all of the lower courts. So there's actually a law that they're talking about to basically prevent individual federal judges from doing that. All right, I just realized a whole bunch of people came in. Allison is here. No, Elizabeth. Nick made it in. Jimmy.
Is it Pele, who's the president of El Salvador? He had a great response to that. He just posted on Twitter. Whoops.
Yep.
They're right here.
Yep. Too late. All right, any questions on executive orders? So as far as everything that you're hearing about the news, the best advice I can give you is stay tuned.
Well, it depends which court it goes before. Because that's the sad thing. You know, that's one of the sad things, side note, tangent. One of the saddest things about America today, we don't have justice. We have politics in our courts. So if you are a Democrat and doing a Democrat thing and you go before a Democrat judge, you're going to be let off or let go. Or if you're a conservative doing conservative things and you go before a conservative judge, you're going to get let off and get let go. But how is that justice being blind?
You know, that's one of the things that I hope I can see the pendulum kind of go back to the center in all things in our country. Because this, left, right, it's just not good. All right. Commander-in-Chief. The Commander-in-Chief powers are inherent in Article 2, Section 1, Clause 1. Because the framers of the Constitution wanted to make sure the highest military power in our country was a civilian. When they made the Constitution, the militaries of Europe were controlled by people who got their jobs because of birth. Kings. And the only way to get rid of a king was either to have a revolution and cut their head off, and that really didn't happen too many times in European history, or death. And those kings use the armies as their means to control their countries, which ultimately could result in tyranny. In one of my other classes, we were talking about the reign of Louis XIV. Louis XIV did not have a single police officer in the modern sense, but he had a standing army of over 400,000. So if he found out there was crime going on in a village, a detachment of the soldiers went down there and pretty much started shooting people until the guilty were found or proven dead. The Sun King is the epitome of tyranny. And that's not what the Founding Fathers wanted, because they knew history, unlike most people in our country today. So, they put in the Constitution that the POTUS is the commander-in-chief. But they limited the power. Yes, the president has the authority to commit troops. Yes, the president has the authority over the highest ranking members of any military branch, including the Joint Chiefs. But it's Congress that declares war. So, War of 1812, Civil War, Spanish-American War, Mexican-American War, World War I, World War II, all were wars. In a legal sense. Which big two did I leave off?
Vietnam and the Korean War.
7 years war. That's the French and Indian War. We weren't America during the French and Indian War. We were still part of England.
I could have sworn there was a declaration of war for Korea.
There was not. Huh. Korea and Vietnam, legally speaking, are military actions, not wars. Although, tell that to any veteran who served in either conflicts.
Wait, they don't call Vietnam a war?
It's not, legally speaking, a war. It's a military action.
Wow.
So, we got into Korea at the request of the United Nations. So, under the UN Charter, member nations, if one member is attacked, the other members are legally obligated, I think it's Article 5, to provide military support to support the member of the UN against the aggressor. Vietnam, we started, I'm also teaching a class on Vietnam, our first boots on the ground were actually advanced units of a pseudo blend of the CIA and the military.
MacVSOG,
exactly. So basically they went in as advisors, because after the French lost the Indochinese War, we went in there to prop up South Vietnam. We trained the South Vietnamese soldiers. The ARVN was their military force, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. But our position there also got us kind of entangled in governmental actions. Ike really didn't do that much, but when Kennedy came in, Kennedy kind of authorized a coup that resulted in the execution by the military of the president of South Vietnam. That was Diem. He was very, very corrupt, to say the least. Plus, he was thinking about negotiating with Hanoi, and we weren't going to allow him to do that. Then we had a series of generals that served as military juntas, and again, we supported coup after coup after coup after coup. While all that was going on, beginning with JFK, we started sending over more advisors, and more advisors. Because the Viet Cong, who were South Vietnamese that were communists, were getting more and more support from North Vietnam.
Advisors being group race.
Advisors. Yeah, they went out in the field, but technically they were not supposed to engage.
Right.
They could fire back if fired upon,
yeah,
but they couldn't spur the charge.
That's the SF mission, says, to
yeah,
to help the train up.
Right.
our allied combatants.
So anyways, fast forward, the Gulf of Tonkin took place. And what it was three North Vietnamese torpedo boats went and fired at two American cruisers because the Americans, through submarines, had been deploying South Vietnamese special forces to engage in guerrilla operations in North Vietnam. So the North Vietnamese were kind of telling the United States to go away. Well, that was ignored initially. But then 3 days later, a really bad storm took place in the Gulf of Tonkin, which is the body of water off of North Vietnam. And the captains of the ship reported that the radar is going crazy and there are multiple vessels and we're under attack. So planes were deployed, guns were fired. But after all the chaos, there was no proof that they actually hit anything because there was no proof that anyone was there. But LBJ used that incident, got it into the media, caused the media circus, which forced the Congress to grant what was known as the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which gave the president war powers. He could deploy as many men as he deemed necessary. 64, 65, 66, mobilization after mobilization. Before you know it, we got about 500,000 American soldiers in country. We also Americanized the war because the ARVN were not crazy. They didn't want to go into the jungles and die. So we told them, stay home, we'll go. And long story short, 54,000 American deaths later, when Nixon was president, got us out.
So we didn't volunteer to take that. We knew we had to.
We did not have to get involved at all. We chose to. But it was part of the Cold War in containment. And the domino theory.
Kind of a proxy.
That's the thing with America, man. Always getting involved in stuff that we have no business being a part of. I can't stand it.
Well, American history. We didn't get involved. We ignored what was going on, and that resulted in two world wars. So after World War II, the United States government basically said, we're tired of it. So we're going to become the world police.
And there's been times that it's worked out. I mean, Korea, kind of 50-50. Desert Storm, that was exactly what we wanted to happen. We ended up going back to Iraq later.
Right.
But, I mean, that was a perfect example of us being the world police.
Right.
And it actually, you know, 100%.
Working out well. 100%. Gage?
I'm trying to find what it's called, because I watched it last year in a Vietnamese history class that I took. It's about this eye doctor that goes around, like, kind of getting, like, the history of the Vietnamese War. It was so good and very introspective about it. I want to email my professor and find what it was called.
On my bucket list, that's one of the goals. My father was there for 2 years. I want to go see.
It's a really good movie. I'll see if I can get you the name of it because it's very introspective.
Because besides his opinions on the VC, he also fought North Vietnamese regulars. He loved the Vietnamese people.
And yeah, my grandfather was there.
Yeah.
And you've seen that Good Morning Vietnam?
Yes.
It's one of my favorite movies.
Oh yeah, that's a classic.
Yeah.
All right. After Vietnam, though, Congress did attempt to negate the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution when they passed the War's Powers Resolution. This required the president to work in concert with Congress before a United States military forces were mobilized. But I hate to break it to you, no president has followed this. It's always been ignored. Gerry Ford got us into Cambodia. Ronald Reagan got us in Lebanon, Grenada, Libya. George W. Bush got us in Panama. If I would have gone in, that would have been my war. Clinton, Somalia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Sudan, Bosnia. George W. Bush, Iraq, Afghanistan, no declarations of war.
All police actions on those?
All police actions, technically speaking. Who's the only other president in the history since World War II not to commit boots on the ground anywhere on earth?
You said it before. I know you said it before.
It was Trump during his first term. Trump.
That was it, really?
Yep.
Beirut was terrible.
It could have been Biden as well, but Biden increased troops in the Gulf.
Yeah.
Two of my buddies ended up going back.
Oh, wow.
They weren't happy. But they came back safe, so. Although one of his guys, and when you heard about on the news with all the rockets that were being fired into Iraq,
right.
What they were doing, with Iran was shooting them at military, U.S. military installations.
Couple concussions, I heard.
Yeah, one of the guys from the guy down in the Cape. Yeah, he got bad concussed. All right. What about foreign affairs? Well, Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2 gives the president the penultimate position in foreign affairs. And he can do multiple things. The president has the authority to make a treaty. A treaty is a legally binding agreement between two nations. But here's the catch, and this goes back to the compromises that culminated in the creation of our Constitution. The United States will only agree to a treaty if 2/3 of the Senate confirm it. It takes 2/3 confirmation by the Senate. FYI, one of the most gruesome treaties of the 20th century, the Treaties of Versailles, 1919. The agreement in which the Empire of Germany was basically forced to accept full responsibility for World War I. But for that treaty, there would have never been a World War II. But the British and the French wanted to basically squeeze the German lemon until the pips were squeaked. They wanted to punish Germany, even though they were just as guilty.
It did not work out well.
No. But the United States Senate refused to sign the Treaty of Versailles. Because contained in the Treaty of Versailles was the creation of the League of Nations, which was the prototype for the UN. And the Republicans did not want to get us bound into an international organization, which we did after World War II.
But on our terms, theoretically.
Theoretically, but... seeing how we pay 50% of the UN budget, yeah. And all of the UN ambassadors and delegates from all over the world have complete diplomatic immunity, so they can do whatever they want in New York City. It's insane. I got one of my buddies who's a cop down there.
Too.
What?
Lethal weapon too. Diplomatic immunity.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Now I got one of my buddies who's a cop in New York City. He hates it whenever the UN's in session. Because that's usually when all like the prostitutes come into New York City and the drugs, you know, spike and like the cops can't do anything about it.
Except Roger Murtaugh.
Can I ask you a question while it's about to get down?
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm doing my paper on Doge, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so because of all like the federal government funds and positions that they're cutting,
yeah.
I've been noticing on the news lately that they're saying there's going to be a lot less food and drug inspections. There's going to be a lot less cruise ship inspections. There's going to be effects on gardening and supplies of food and stuff.
Who's saying it?
Who's saying this?
Yeah.
Right.
Who's
now,
saying it?
It's in the media right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, but who's saying it?
It's Doge is doing.
That's not what I'm asking you.
I'm not sure who's saying it.
Okay. You have to look at who's saying it, because that's the nature of politics. The people who are complaining are the people that are losing their benefits as a result. So the people who were corrupt are not going to be able to be corrupt. So what are they doing? They're throwing everything out there. It's the same reason why when a town can't afford a 2.5 property tax override, while you have people that come with the schools out of the schools. Oh, the children are going to not get education, and people are like firefighters are going to get laid off, and there's going to be no cops, and the seniors are going to suffer. It's just politics.
So, like, even that stuff that they broadcast on the news is just a lie?
Yeah. The news, no matter what, and I said that before, no matter what network you get your news from, there is no constitutional or federal or state law that they have to tell the truth. And they don't. So that's the reason why I said, if you want to know if something's truthful, you got to look at multiple sources, and the truth is always somewhere in between. But the problem is a lot of people just see the first thing that they see, particularly if it's on TikTok, and they think it's true. And I will put Mrs. Professor Lemanic in that category. She doesn't listen to my recordings, so I'm not, she's not going to, like, seek revenge.
Thing is like, I could see it, though. Like, I mean, yeah, I heard about it yesterday and didn't really cross-reference it or research it or whatever, but in my mind, it adds up. It makes sense.
If the government, if they're talking about cutting government positions, look at the positions they're cutting. Are they cutting inspectors, or are they cutting the secretaries?
They're cutting a lot of funds to schools and stuff like that right now.
What are the funds? I didn't hear that schools were getting any funds. I heard they're going after the Department of Education, but I haven't heard any funds were cut.
NIL, I think they were saying, what is it, college stuff, uniforms. Schools can't get the uniforms or whatever because they don't have the money for the...
Does a college sports team having uniforms have to do anything with educational services?
No.
Okay. That's what I mean. You really got to think about the stuff that you see in the news. And don't stop thinking about it. And don't stop digging deeper and deeper and deeper. Because if it's in the news, it's because somebody has an agenda. But whose agenda?
Okay.
And it's not easy, my friend. It's not easy. That's one of the reasons why I went bald when I was a young age. Because you know what I spend every free waking moment of my time doing? Research and reading.
So any given information you see on the media, it's up to each person to interpret how they may and do with it what they will.
100%.
They perceive it as a lie, or they look into it and find the truth, which is always hidden in the middle of whatever you're seeing.
Yeah.
Okay.
And plus, don't forget, truth is always in the eye of the beholder.
It's one of my favorites now.
It is. And you got to be mindful of that. Because just because you perceive something as the truth, that doesn't mean it is. And by the way, I don't know the truth either. But I'll tell you this. I can tell you, I know a lot less than the stuff I don't know. So what I know is tiny compared to what I don't know. All right. Another foreign power. Oh, they appoint ambassadors. I skipped over that one real quick. They appoint ambassadors. So we have, by treaty, the right to send ambassadors to most of the countries on Earth. Well, there are some countries like North Korea, for example, Cuba, that we don't have ambassadors. But those positions are determined by treaty, and the president appoints them with the advice and consent of the Senate. So ambassadors have hearings, you just don't see them on TV. Unless you watch the C-SPANs, like I do. The president also has a right to receive not only foreign ambassadors, but also foreign officials. So, this is in Oslo. Reagan sat down with Gorbachev. And this is where Reagan basically walked out on negotiations for nuclear disarmament. He pulled a Trumpian negotiation strategy. Gorbachev was like, no, we want to have this many nukes. And Reagan was like, yeah, I'm not talking to you. He just got up and left. I think this is at Yalta. You got Winston Churchill, FDR, Stalin. They're trying to figure out, you know, how to end World War II. We got Bill Clinton. I think that's the president of Pakistan. I don't remember. And, of course, you got Trump with Bibi Netanyahu. What can they do? They can talk. And, by the way, if you've been listening to the news, the whole tariff brouhaha, I believe India, Japan, Vietnam, Canada... There was about 12 different countries that have already contacted the White House, and they want to negotiate. The only nation that Trump said no to was China, which I loved. I thought that was hilarious.
What about the island, the tariffs on that's inhabited entirely by penguins?
Yeah, I saw that. That's just out of principle.
That's insane.
Yep. All right. Now, in terms of foreign powers, I can't say one way or another because it depends. Ultimately, as we know, the ultimate arbiter on what a president can do is the Supreme Court. And over the history of our country, the SCOTUS has been inconsistent. So, for example, as recent as 1936, in a case U.S. Curtis Wright Export Corp., you don't have to remember that, the Supreme Court basically said the president's power in foreign policy, the foreign arena, is unlimited. But then, just 16 years later, in Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company v. Sawyer, the Supreme Court said, no, there's a zone of twilight that exists. So you take the literal words of the Constitution, and there's your zone in between. So the farther that the president gets away from the express powers, the more Congress can regulate. What does that mean? Well, the president cannot... I'm trying to give you a good example. The president cannot rip up a treaty. If there is a treaty that was signed by Congress, the president cannot rip up a treaty. But the president can put restrictions on that treaty agreement. If that makes sense. Questions?
Is there really a country full of penguins?
No, it's an island.
An island?
Yeah. All right, there are a whole bunch of extra constitutional powers, and there are also checks, but we don't have enough time to get through any of those. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop now, and I'm going to throw out a reminder that you do have your paper, which is coming due. That is worth 20% of your final grade. Do not be late on that one, because as outlined on proflamanic.com, one of the most significant penalties that could push your grade down into the negatives is late submission of papers. So I'm telling you now, no late submissions will be accepted. So get her done. And I don't want to hear the day of, oh, my computer crashed. Because you know what happened to me? Remember last class when I was screaming up here? I put my drive in. The stupid computer scanned my drive and it wiped my record of this class. Good thing I had it backed up. But I'm like, WTF. But did I whine? No, I've got it done. So I'm going to hold you accountable on your paper. Unless you're like the one person that got it in before the deadline and is going to get extra credit for early submission.
Do you want like a specific credit for the citing?
It's on proflamanic.com.
Okay.
What I'm looking for is it has to be in Chicago format, style of paper, and I want you to use footnotes. So no MLA, no ABA, or any of those other funky things. Chicago-style. And by the way, there's a ton of information. It's not that hard. And with that modern computer, your computer can actually do most of the work for you.
Good afternoon.
We're still creating a works cited, though, right?
Yes, you still have to have a bibliography or works cited section.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I looked it up. It wasn't a documentary on the Vietnam War. It was about the Indonesian genocide. It's still really good, though.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, that was...